Jenny Drysdale from the Centre for Environmental Studies at the ANU, the Fenner School. Thank you for talking to Community Radio 2 FM.
Hi, how are you?
Jennifer, you spent 2 years in Timor and doing your research. Could you tell us a little bit about when you were there and a little bit about your research?
Sure. I've been doing a PhD on the Petroleum Fund and whether East Timor can avoid the resource curse. And I was really interested in finding out whether people outside of government and people within civil society, how they felt about the decisions that had been made in terms of how the petroleum revenue would be managed. So I was asking, on the one hand, about the priorities in the budget. So what the people, both the decision makers and the people in civil society, thought the priorities were for expenditure. And my research was done in 2004-05, so it was before the crisis. And I think that it reveals some interesting things about people's priorities in what was, I guess, most considered a relatively peaceful time. So they prioritised health and education as the items that required the most priority in terms of budget expenditure. And interestingly, the lowest three priorities were police, youth and sport, and defence, and that was in 2005. So I think that it shows that the people on the street weren't really perceiving that there was any issues with those institutions at the time that I did my research.
And there were some very carefully thought out decisions about when and how the oil should be exploited.
Yes, I chose to use the Greater Sunrise Field, which is the petroleum field that is East Timor's largest petroleum field, and the one which the negotiations between Australia and East Timor really centred on. And I was asking people whether they would prioritise the exploitation of Greater Sunrise, that is to exploit it as soon as possible so that they could earn more revenue sooner than later, whether they thought that the Greater Sunrise should be not exploited until maritime boundaries were resolved, or whether they thought that that East Timor should wait until future generations could decide.
Given, was this people in the street, or like government people, or?
I was asking both decision makers and people within civil society, so people working in NGOs, people in the districts working as teachers, health workers, people in the church, and community leaders. So a whole range of different people outside of government. So, interestingly, my results showed that around half of the participants thought that Greater Sunrise should be exploited as soon as possible, and around about the other half thought that East Timor should wait until the maritime boundaries with Australia were resolved. And of course, this was prior to the conclusion of the International Unitisation Agreement and ratification of the Greater Sunrise Agreement. So, and what was interesting about those results was that when I looked at who it was that prioritised the exploitation of Greater Sunrise, it was mostly the decision makers, and civil society really made up the other half, who prioritised the delay based on waiting for a maritime boundary to be resolved. So it shows that in this case, the decision that the government took didn't really reflect, in terms of my participant sample, which is may or may not be representative of the larger sample of the East Timorese population, but in this particular decision, the government and the population were at odds with each other. Now, obviously, the government and the decision makers had in mind that exploiting Greater Sunrise as soon as possible would provide the opportunities for economic development that the country needs, and so that was their reasoning behind that.
So it's actually the reverse situation of what I think some of the Australian media would have us believe, that it was the leadership that was dragging its feet rather than vice versa.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that's quite a common thing in East Timor, because the population of East Timor doesn't really have a voice in the Australian media. It's really a case of the decision makers of East Timor are represented in the Australian media.
Now, there was some quite strong debate and statements made during the election campaign about East Timor's relationship with the IMF and world financial lending institutions. Alkatiri insisted that East Timor should be as independent as possible of the IMF, and I believe Shanana even recently is talking about getting more money and spending.
Yes, as part of my research, I was asking my respondents whether they thought East Timor should take money out of the petroleum fund or whether they should leave the money in the fund and take a loan from an international financial institution like the IMF or the World Bank. And what the respondents told me was that they were very much against borrowing money from an international financial institution. In fact, 21% of the respondents thought that borrowing money from an international financial institution was a good idea, whilst 79% were in favour of withdrawing their own East Timorese money from the petroleum fund and using that. And I think it ties in with the whole sense of independence that is so strong in East Timor, that they want to be responsible for their own future and for the way in which the country is managed.
And you did similar surveys on what people thought about, well, how much money should be taken out of the fund.
Yes, at the time that I did my research, the value of estimated sustainable income was $100 million. So I was questioning people whether they thought that the government should withdraw less than $100 million, more than $100 million, or a value equal to, so that to try and get an understanding of whether the sustainability of the fund was important to people. What I found was that 78% of the respondents were absolutely adamant that the government didn't take more than $100 million out of the fund at that time. So they were very strongly telling me that the management of the fund should be sustainable, and that it shouldn't take the government shouldn't take more than the sustainable amount from the funds. So if Shanana does pursue the idea of taking out more than a sustainable amount, that will be contrary to the majority of the participants in my research.
Jenny has just finished doing some very important research on petroleum revenue management in East Timor. The petroleum fund has been established by the former government of East Timor, but it was set up to overcome the resource curse. Jen, could you just tell us what the resource curse is?
Sure. So it's a phenomenon that's largely considered in economic terms, and it's when a country has a huge influx of wealth from natural resources. They may be exploiting their forests or their oil or their gas reserves, and they can't use that money wisely. For example, in Nauru, which is an example that probably a lot of people would know of, they were once upon a time the richest per capita people in the world, and they invested that money, and they had a great plan to avoid the resource curse, but the investments didn't go so well, and they've ended up once again one of the poorest people per capita in the world.
And there were some fears that East Timor could go the same way with the oil revenue.
Yes. East Timor is obviously in the same situation. They have a huge reliance on their petroleum resources to earn the revenue that they need to build their country and hopefully to enable sustainable development. But of course, there are very few countries that have avoided the resource curse in the developing world. And so it was necessary to think about the way in which they should manage that revenue coming from the resources to best ensure that they could achieve sustainable development. So the government, as you mentioned, established a petroleum fund, which supposedly will create the mechanisms that enable East Timor to avoid the resource curse.
Can you explain some of the details of how that fund works?
Sure. The petroleum fund is created under a law which creates certain guidelines and mechanisms on how the revenue is managed. One of the main things is that at this time, 100% of the revenue that's earned from petroleum is deposited into a bank account, which is called the Petroleum Fund, managed by the central bank, and at the moment they've invested that in the US Federal Reserve. So that is earning a very conservative rate of return, but the law does allow for them to invest 10% of the revenue in other forms of investments. But at this stage, the central bank and the government have decided that it's best until the people develop the capacity to manage the broader kinds of investments that that it remains in that kind of conservative level of investment.
During the recent election campaign, the Fretilin government, who set this up, have been quite strongly criticised. There were talks of, you know, $1 billion being locked up and nothing happening to it.
One of the other major mechanisms under the Petroleum Fund law is that the government can withdraw, and only by authority of the parliament, an amount from the Petroleum Fund which goes straight into the budget. So it can't be spent anywhere else. And they have a guideline called Estimated Sustainable Income, which is a formula which allows the country to withdraw from the fund an amount such that they could withdraw the same amount forever without ever drawing down the fund in its entirety. So that principle of only taking as much that would be sustainable is a really good one. So when the Fretilin government was in power, they did not withdraw greater than the sustainable amount, and in fact they withdrew quite a substantial amount less than their sustainable amount, and that I think is what people have criticised them for, because they didn't see that progress was occurring on the ground, particularly in the rural areas. However, the reason that they didn't withdraw a greater amount is because the government institutions, the ministries, the line ministries, are not yet able to execute budget. So there are problems in terms of purchasing and in terms of actually rolling out the projects that need to be executed. So, for example, in the 2005-06 budget year, the budget was $130 million, and during the year they only managed to actually spend $82 million, so 63% of that budget. They had actually committed to spend $120 million, but those commitments weren't actually realised within the budget year.
Would you say the disturbances of last year, could it be seen as a contributing factor in the underspending?
Well, the disturbances happened at the end of that budget year. So this is obviously because the Treasury reports on the budget year and takes actually about 9 months before they're reporting. So we don't actually have the figures from the last financial year yet in terms of how much was executed. However, I would imagine that, yes, those obviously the government was affected in its terms in terms of its ability to execute expenditure and run its programs. So I think we will see an effect on the budget execution in the most recent budget year, yes.
And there's talk now with the new government of using more of this fund, and there seems to be a lot of confusion. Different people are saying different things. I understand you were in contact with people in Dili recently. Give us an outline of what the new government's policy is going to be radically different from the Fretland policy on the petroleum fund. Or
there's actually nothing in writing yet from the CNRT party on what their policies are with regards to the petroleum fund and withdrawing, although I have heard both Ramaswata and Janana Gushmao saying that they will withdraw more revenue from the petroleum fund. Whether that means that they will withdraw more than a sustainable amount is yet to be seen. However, I spoke to Alfredo Perez, who is the new Secretary of State for Natural Resources, and he explained, and we've just seen today the media release from the government cabinet, who has approved at what they're calling a transitional budget for the rest of this financial year, which is just $108 million. So that's very much less than a sustainable amount, and it's also a very realistic amount to expect to spend in the rest of this financial year. So at this stage, they are not doing anything different than Fretland would have done, and they're also acting quite conservatively in this transitional time. And I don't think that... I'm not exactly sure what the value of estimated sustainable income is at the moment, because it depends on how much the petroleum fund has grown. But it was around $300 million. So they would have to increase the budget a huge amount in order to be suspending at unsustainable levels. So I think the more important thing is to improve that level of budget execution, and I think that they're certainly having plans to do that.
So by all indications, they seem to be recognising the wisdom of the fund as it is.
Yes, I think they are, and I think they also recognise the problems of the new government and the nascent nature of the institutions that they're working with. Amelia Perez is the new Minister for Planning and Finance, and she actually has a really good background in East Timor, both in East Timor and in Australian government institutions. So she's well placed to establish the kinds of processes that are needed to improve the execution of the budget, and I think that she'll be a really good Minister for Planning and Finance. Amelia used to be the head of the National Planning and Development Authority and was responsible for overseeing the National Development Plan, which has to date led East Timor in a very sustainable direction in terms of prioritising health and education, and she did that under the Fretland government. So she's well placed to have a big picture in terms of how the finances of the government should be directed.
And what about Fretland? Has there been any response from Fretland about the government's policy on the petroleum fund?
The comments that I have seen by Fretland in response to CNRT policies to date have really been about the more sort of overarching issues about the fact that it is going to take generations to create sustainable development, and I think it's really hard for Fretland at this stage to be pinpointing things that CNRT is not doing the way they would like, because there's sort of really not yet, hasn't been enough time for them to be practically putting out any policies or so on.
So it's early days.
Yeah, very early days.
I've just been reading Paul Cleary's book about the abysmal behaviour of the Australian government in negotiating the oil. And there was an interesting chapter there where he talks about the Timor Sea Justice Campaign and a few other organisations and individuals, including Ian Melrose. What role did the Australian and international solidarity play in the negotiations? I mean, we get the impression from our government that it was high-level meetings between Timorese and Australian ministers and VIPs, but you get the impression from Paul's chapter that some of the more grassroots and NGO, non-government organisations, played a role.
Oh, absolutely. I would agree with Paul on that point. The Timor Sea Justice Campaign, and Ian Melrose in particular, obviously had a great amount of influence on the end result, because they brought to the attention of the Australian public the issue that was on the table. And I think that that did significantly affect the way in which the Australian government responded to the East Timorese. Very powerful negotiators, really. Murray Alkatiri and Peter Galbraith did do a very phenomenal amount of work in saying no to the Australian government when they first assumed that East Timor would just accept that the agreement that Australia had with Indonesia would just continue. Peter Galbraith, of course, is the person who represented the United Nations Transitional Administration in East Timor, and at the time, prior to East Timor's independence, was the person who negotiated on behalf of the East Timorese with the Australian government. But obviously, following independence, Murray Alkatiri did fight a very hard bargain, and I think it's to his credit and to the credit of José Teixeira, who was then the Secretary of State for Natural Resources, who were able to win for East Timor a really good deal in the end, and one that I think the Australian government, if you'd asked them in 1999, wouldn't have expected this outcome.